Welcome to episode 159 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is the writer and critic Adam Naiman. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New Republic, The Ringer, and Sight and Sound, one of my very favorite people to talk to about film, and I chose a good one. Adam, welcome back to the show.
I'm delighted, delighted to be back to talk about a real progressive piece of contemporary American cinema.
Our subject for today is my most problematic fave, Michael Cimino's 1985 action film Year of the Dragon, starring Mickey Rourke, John Lone, and introducing Ariane. I think Adam understands why I love this movie. This is one of the most hyperbolic and most ludicrous movies I've ever seen. The first time I saw this movie was on opening day in 70mm at the University Theater in Toronto, and I could not believe what I was seeing. There's only so much you can defend with this movie, but I want to try and make a case for why it is actually an accidental masterpiece.
Stanley White survived the jungles of Vietnam to become the most decorated cop in New York City.
There the difference was I never saw the enemy. Here they're right in front of my eyes. They got no place to hide, no jungles.
Now he's got a new war on his hands. And he doesn't plan to lose this one. Year of the Dragon, rated R. Starts Friday. Check newspapers for a theater near you.
Adam, before we really get going on this movie, I wanted to hear your thoughts about Michael Cimino and his legacy. You were there in Locarno the year the festival paid tribute to Cimino, and yeah. You got to see this movie for the first time the way it should be seen in a movie theater. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, not just in a movie theater, but in what felt like a converted hangar, basically, you know, in Locarno that year. It was a full retrospective of Cimino, who attended, and this was not the very end of his life, but, you know, certainly out the other end of his celebrity and sort of hiatus from filmmaking, a certain amount of rumor and enigma and mystique around his final years, seclusion, rumors about, gender transition, which are raised and addressed also more subsequently in Charles Elton's book about the filmmaker. I think we're referring to Cimino as Elton does in the book as he at the time of Year of the Dragon, right? But there is some, you know, fascinating evidence and speculation and testimony about a gender change towards the end of Cimino's life. This was a retrospective that was done really in a sort of very pugnacious, defiant, against the canon kind of way, right? Where the festival was like, here's a great filmmaker whose movies should be more esteemed. And it's not quite on the ground floor, because I think at that point, Heaven's Gate had already been done by Criterion. It's not like the Michael Cimino wars hadn't been fought critically prior to this. But it was still sort of at a point, I think, where there felt like there was something at stake. And seeing all of these young European cinephiles, whether it was out in the open piazza or in the theater where we happen to see Year of the Dragon, you know, piling in there, and Cimino introducing the films and seeming very moved by the experience. I wrote about it for the TFCA blog, for the Toronto Film Critics Association blog. I couldn't really place a piece anywhere else at that point, but decided to write about going to this European festival. And it was also interesting, I don't know if you knew this, but they had that retro paired with one on Sam Peckinpah. And I thought, talk about a fascinating comparison of filmmakers who left it all on the screen and who really shot the works and went for broke, made a lot of movies that could be considered either autobiographical or valedictory or sort of both. And I will say that in that week of leveraging newish art films against these old Hollywood monsters, the old Hollywood monsters not only came out on top, but my first viewing of Year of the Dragon, because I'm a little younger than you, I didn't grow up with it in the 80s, and it wasn't that easy to see on home video, I think, in the 90s, or at least I never was in a store that rented it. Here, seeing it on that scale, I mean, I have to say it was a tremendously memorable experience. And an experience that I think builds a foundation of an appreciation for it, or at least contemplating it, that, you know, would make me agree to want to have a chat like this. Because in some ways, talking about this movie is a no-win situation, right? Like, we'll talk about just how absolutely stridently appalling it is. And it's not just something to laugh off. I mean, it's gross, but it's a thing. It's a fascinating thing. And to me, it's no more fraught than talking about The Deer Hunter, or no less fraught than talking about The Deer Hunter, right? Mm-hmm. It's because it belongs to the canon. You can sort of talk about it and its flaws because you're talking about an Oscar-winning movie. I think Year of the Dragon is the equal of The Deer Hunter in every way, good and bad. That might be the hot take. Mm-hmm. The Year of the Dragon is as much a movie, you know, of its moment as Deer Hunter was, and that's why we should talk about it historically.
Cimino's a director who's most associated with two of his seven films, the Oscar winner The Deer Hunter, and then a few years later, the historical disaster Heaven's Gate, which is often described as the movie that destroyed United Artists. That is not exactly true. I believe Charles Elton explains further in his book.
He does, but the myth of Heaven's Gate is such a good one. That you have this studio founded by, you know, talk about an Avengers Assemble, you know, Fairbanks and
Charlie Chaplin,
Pickford and Chaplin and Griffith. You know, speaking of problematic auteurs, you know, forming this company essentially to talk about, you know, the rights of artists to express and control, and then, you know, 6 years later, someone who had, you know, written a Clint Eastwood movie and, you know, won an Oscar comes around and makes something where the center can no longer hold. And when you consider, if you read Final Cut, the Stephen Back book, that United Artists was dealing on one front, on the home front with Cimino, and then somewhere in Southeast Asia, you have Coppola literally trying to fight the Vietnam War.
Yeah. The Vietnam War on two fronts.
was really putting a strain on that studio. I mean, that was in a period where lots of studios were switching ownership or merging, you know, that period of conglomerates taking over Hollywood. So the brick and mortar studios no longer belonged to the immigrant families who built them, but they were kind of cashing out, you know. But Heaven's Gate is a great movie to point the finger at. And I think in the moment it was like pointing the finger at it as a perpetrator. And now it's more poetic to see it as a victim. Right? Like Star Wars is the one lurking in the background that like stabbed it in the back, or Superman or Jaws. You pick your movie, right? Mm-hmm. And that Heaven's Gate is more of a tragic victim of a film culture where people just didn't have the attention span for a 3-hour movie about land rights, you know, in roller skating in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the movie's fault that Star Wars ruined that. But Cimino is, to me, he is the poster child of the new Hollywood, not the greatest of the directors, but the poster child for everything that myth means, even if it's sort of a bit of a banal myth or a familiar myth. That's what people think of when they think of that idea.
This is what I'm getting to, that, you know, The Deer Hunter and Heaven's Gate are considered, you know, the high and low of Cimino's career. But in my mind, and I'd be curious to hear what you think about this, Adam, to me, Year of the Dragon is the third chapter in Cimino's trilogy about the immigrant experience in America.
Yeah, it's a good read, right? I mean, I agree. And I think that, you know, the Deer Hunter obviously deals with characters who, you know, in this working class environment, you know, like America's not just a melting pot, but I mean, literally this is like a melting pot kind of profession, you know, these steel workers, this forging of materials, you know, this Greek Orthodox wedding, definitely suggesting people who've come from somewhere else. And then this war that the film, I don't know what you think about The Deer Hunter, but it's one of those movies that goes beyond pro or anti-war. You know, it's so excited to use war as an all-purpose metaphor and as an all-purpose texture. It never really gets around to being pro or anti. Certainly it's racist, you know, and invented in so many of the details. We should say that Cimino, among other things, was quite the fabulist.
Yes. You
know, the making of that movie is just a morass of like stolen valor, stolen credit, ideas that were, you know, reworked by other people, and just a phenomenal amount of talent that he had too. Mm-hmm. As a writer, as a director, as a casting of actors. But yeah, and then Heaven's Gate, which he wanted to make from at the beginning. That's the first script he ever wrote, right? He then had to go back, I think, and show that he could write like more conventional movies. So he wrote Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And I think with John Milius, he wrote Magnum Force. You know, always a little bit of a martial right wing sensibility there in the beginning. If you're hanging out with John Milius, you know, you're
rub off on you, and or Clint Eastwood. It's going to rub off.
Or Clint Eastwood. You know, the boys as we know them, Milius and Eastwood. But I mean, Heaven's Gate, as Cimino said, you know, was criticized if anything, like, you know, it's a Marxist movie. You know, it's too left wing, and it's an audacious critique of a country that basically wants to extinguish its own population or its own immigrant population. So by the time you get to Year of the Dragon, which we should set up the narrative of in a second, maybe we can talk about how it came together and then we'll go into the movie and the plot itself. But absolutely, Year of the Dragon dealing with aspects of the American experience, immigrant experience. And as some people said, it's almost as if like the Vietnam War comes home to be fought on the streets of recreated Chinatown. You know, he had to rebuild Chinatown in North Carolina. And Elton in his book suggests no less than Stanley Kubrick, who would go on to know a thing or two about recreating places like Vietnam in London and New York in London. He apparently looked at Year of the Dragon and like couldn't tell that it's not really New York.
The way I heard it is that they arranged a screening of Dragon for Kubrick in London. And when Kubrick was telling him how the Chinatown stuff looked great, Cimino informed him that that was all a set. And right. After a few minutes of arguing about it, Kubrick was shocked. And Cimino figured if you can fool Stanley Kubrick, then you can fool anybody.
Yeah, as a brief little sidebar, I should say, you know, it's too bad Kubrick's not around for the one thing I'd love to congratulate him for, which is like he is the greatest straight man in other people's stories about him. Mm-hmm. There are so many great stories about Kubrick being surprised by what other filmmakers tell him. My favorite one, I love it. I love it so much, is the Albert Brooks one.
Yes.
He calls Albert Brooks at his house in the middle of the night. He's like, I have to understand how you directed Modern Romance. And Albert Brooks is like, you're asking me how I made a movie? Yeah. You're calling me to ask how I directed something?
Just did a show on Outland. And when Peter Hyams gave Kubrick a phone call to get permission to make 2010, Kubrick buttonholed him for an hour to ask him all these questions about how he did Outland.
Yeah, for a guy who was supposedly such a misanthrope and a recluse, very kind to other very kind and supportive to other filmmakers. Cimino, on the other hand, you know, very combative, right? And if you read Final Cut, I mean, we don't have to go into the down the Heaven's Gate rabbit hole. I have a feeling most people listen, if they're listening to your podcast at this point, they probably have some sense of Heaven's Gate. But like that book, it can't be overstated how biased it is, because Stephen Bock, who wrote it, was the producer of the movie. I mean, he was
an UA executive too. So you're getting the perspective of the suits about the artist who spent way too much money and damaged the bottom line.
But it's a credible book. I mean, I'm not undercutting Bock. I mean, his point of view is biased. But like the stories about Cimino that come out of that book, the way that he's painted, it's very, I guess it's very subjective. It's a bit of a, you know, a Rorschach for the reader of how you feel about it. But every archetype of the stubborn, entitled, don't fuck with my vision director is bound up in Cimino. Like it's almost a performance, you know?
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you gravitate to that, you know, that Wellesian idea of Final Cut, which is the mythic brass ring in Hollywood to grab if you're a certain kind of director. You know, you read Final Cut and Cimino's not the villain. He's like the tragic hero of the book. And I teach Heaven's Gate in a business of film class here at U of T, we don't watch the whole film because the class isn't built to accommodate watching whole movies, especially not like 4-hour ones. But I show a long section of the movie, and mostly students are just fascinated by the idea that even before the budget swelled and the media was bad and people hated it, that it was greenlit at a higher budget level than Star Wars, because it just wasn't what blockbusters were even a year later, you know? It's not, they're like, oh God, why would they think anyone would go see that? It's that actually the 70s provided a lot of evidence that that movie could have done well. That a culture that made a hit out of The Deer Hunter or a hit out of a movie like Bound for Glory. Mm-hmm. You know, those were adult commercial films. I mean, not to get all cranky, but, you know, Shampoo was a Lines Around the Block.
Yeah.
You know, so certainly Cimino was a bit of a figure out of time.
Let's situate Year of the Dragon with Heaven's Gate. Yeah. And Deer Hunters. The Deer Hunter is a 70s movie, mostly set in the 60s. Heaven's Gate is a sort of 70s movie and an 80s movie at the same time, even though it's set in the 1890s. Year of the Dragon, to me, is a 70s movie in terms of character study and themes, but a pure 80s movie in terms of visual overload, wretched excess.
Well, let's note that probably the reason Dino De Laurentiis, may he rest, God rest his soul, a soldier of cinema and a patron saint of auteurs who he helped when they needed him. You know, sometimes a bit of a devil's bargain. Mm-hmm. But all honor Dino De Laurentiis's impact on a lot of great careers. He probably was able to get a package for that movie together and offer it to Cimino as a recovery project because of the success of things like the Dirty Harry movies, mm-hmm. which Cimino had sort of almost gotten in on the ground floor of a decade earlier. I mean, Year of the Dragon isn't like a Dirty Harry movie that much, but in terms of how can we put a trailer together and sell this to an audience, it's like, yeah, you know, loose cannon cop in an urban wasteland, you know, taking down bad guys and quipping. I mean, that was a kind of movie.
Yeah, it's like Dirty Harry meets The Godfather or something.
Yeah,
the mob stuff from The Godfather.
Yeah, with a certain exoticism, you know, Far East exoticism. So, I mean, the De Laurentiis thing comes when Cimino is basically, you know, on the mat. I mean, he's down, almost out. If you read the Elton book or elsewhere, there were some opportunities that never quite came together. Like, he was, I think, supposed to be the original director for Footloose, which would have been quite a different chapter in American movie history. He was going to work with the novelist Raymond Carver on a project that I think was long gestating and never realized. You know, he was going to do The Pope of Greenwich Village, which ended up being made by somebody else. So De Laurentiis sort of came to him and said, let's get you back in the ring. Right.
And let's work with Oliver Stone.
Well, the Stone thing was that I think in order to convince him to bring Stone on to Year of the Dragon, he showed him the Platoon screenplay, which Cimino thought was good. And of course he did, because it's so indebted to
Deer Hunter.
so indebted to Deer Hunter. But yeah, the idea with and De Laurentiis, I believe, you get me if I'm wrong, or you'll cut it if I'm wrong, but he produced the first Death Wish, mm-hmm. right? So I mean, he knows this idea of the urban vigilante movie has some legs. So in the Elton book, they talk about how it was, you know, a novel by Robert Daly, and it was just kind of sitting around waiting for someone to make it. De Laurentiis had the rights; he knew it was commercial material. Came to Cimino and basically said, let's give you a chance to like do your thing, like stretch out and make it your way, but you can't have Final Cut because the context of Heaven's Gate, where Final Cut had literally led to, if you believe Stephen back, they were like thinking of killing him. You know, like not only were they thinking of like bringing in David Lean to finish it, they were like, we need to murder him. He just couldn't give him final cut. So they had this arrangement which was sort of agreed and understood that Cimino didn't have final cut, but it said he did.
Mm-hmm.
Like face saving.
Yeah, they had I think they made a public announcement that he had final cut, but private arrangement that he actually didn't. I think that came up during a lawsuit over the Sicilian, I think was when that was revealed.
Yes, later. The Sicilian had its own lawsuit the same way that this movie had. If not lawsuit, it was it eventually like charges of what? Like it was officially charged with racism by an Asian American protest group, which we'll talk about in a minute.
We will. Yeah.
But also to point out, if people are like, well, after Heaven's Gate, why did De Laurentiis want to risk, you know, $25 million? I mean, he was only as far removed from The Deer Hunter and Best Picture at this point as like Guillermo del Toro is now from Shape of Water.
Yeah.
We are only talking 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a calculated risk.
This is it. I'll give it to you fast. There's a new marshal in town. Me. I'm tired of all this Chinese this, Chinese that.
I got a complaint about you already.
You think gambling, extortion, corruption are kosher?
You're only meant to shake up the gang kids.
You're not special. You're not beyond the law.
That is the way the game is played.
I've been in the job 15 years. I know all the stories.
What Chinese mafia?
My heart has been broken 100 times.
The investigation's in your mind.
I've got scar tissue on my soul.
You don't like it, resign.
You're a great cop, but nobody likes you, Stanley. The point here is you cease and desist.
Nobody wants to win this thing, do you? I want to change things.
Why? Is Chinatown so bad the way it is?
This is the thing that I find so fascinating about Year of the Dragon is that it's supposedly a commercial movie and it's supposedly Cimino being on good behavior. But this movie is set mostly in New York, but it was only partially filmed in New York. Most of the film was made at De Laurentiis' production stages in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, as we were saying, the reproduction of Chinatown there, which is so antithetical to sort of the gritty reality of, say, the French Connection,
mm-hmm.
which still was only a decade old at that point, mm-hmm. you know, 10, 12 years, or the Sidney Lumet New York cop films, which just pulsate with authenticity.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, we're going to get into this in our discussion is that Year of the Dragon, the other thing that I responded so strongly to this movie is that there is a sort of realism and authenticity, but there's also this hyper-realism and artifice in the film. Like there's something that seems real, but is completely fake. And I remember being stunned by the experience of watching this. One of the movies that also struck a huge chord with me when I was a kid was Robert Altman's Popeye, which was also the same production designer. That city that he built, Sweet Haven in Malta, same production designer. So he created this artificial Mott Street. It's not a faithful recreation of Mott Street in Chinatown, but Mott Street was the model for sort of an amalgamation of all the different Chinatowns in the world. So right down to like newspapers on the newspaper stands, ads for the fake TV network that's in the movie are, you know, and bus shelters. They took plaster casts of curbstones and the grade of the street in Mott Street in Chinatown to recreate on the soundstage. So the eye takes in, you know, when it sees three blocks down the street, there's a natural sort of curve to the road that is sort of the circumference of the earth.
Well, and it's funny because that speaks to the production designer, I believe, is Wolf Croker, who's great, you know. Glad you mentioned Popeye. I mean, Popeye was supposed to, again, create a kind of comic book reality, but to shoot ahead in history and go to another New York recreated movie like, say, Eyes Wide Shut, or something that even parodies that idea, like Schenectady, New York, which is the idea of like just building, you know, a city on a soundstage. I mean, it all speaks to that directorial idea of control. And here's the thing. If you watch Eyes Wide Shut, whatever you think of it, that control is very evident in the tone and the execution of the movie. I mean, even when the film is surreal or strange or arbitrary, it's surreal or strange or arbitrary in a controlled way. What's so funny about Year of the Dragon is the film is completely impulsive and explosive and undisciplined. Within that framework of recreated control, it's sort of like he wants it down to the millimeter to feel authentic so that he can manipulate, you know, lighting and color and composition. I mean, that's a master filmmaker working with all those resources. But then what's within those frames and within those spaces, and I don't mean slovenly filmmaking. I just mean crazy shit happening.
Yeah, like method acting and hyperbolic dialogue, nothing related to the actual planet that we live on, but all this work went into recreating the planet.
Or all the work that goes into the scene where the movie leaves New York, I believe, to go to Thailand.
Yes.
Right? For a meeting with – is it a local
– the heroin dealer in Thailand who's
– in Thailand, and you sort of go, most movies just would say that that happened. You know, oh, you're back from Thailand. And he just does it. And he doesn't just do it. He does it with like these long tracking shots past hundreds – of extras, and it was like a fortress, and you sort of are just like, this is incredible production value. Mm-hmm. You know,
this is why we go to the movies. Like, we don't get that sort of
one reason why. Yeah,
yeah, that's true. But you know, like, so much energy went into what could have been in a line of dialogue. After his trip from Thailand, Joey Tai, the villain played by John Lone, lands at the airport, shot in Vancouver, and gets grilled by Tracy Zhu, the reporter who's after him. And what they talk about in that scene could have supplanted the actual footage of the sequence in Thailand.
It's like
I actually see it.
Yeah, as other critics have pointed out, it's like that little transitional scene in Michael Mann's The Insider, a movie I know you treasure as I do, where the Comfiore character is introduced like flying a plane.
Yeah.
He really has to be flying that plane because that's something he does as an amateur pilot on top of his job as, I think, a lawyer. And Mann's like, do it, you know? I mean, that's like probably an extra $330,000 onto the movie's budget to shoot that scene in for a couple hours. But that's when you know you're feeling it as a director.
The way that the movie starts, we're a black screen and we see the opening titles in blood red. But after the credits are finished, we suddenly find ourselves plunged on the set of the fake New York Chinatown in this movie. Another contemporary movie that the opening sequence reminded me of is Blade Runner, with all this energy poured into creating this world.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned Blade Runner because, you know, that's a movie where even if Ridley Scott's not that interested in it, so much is meant to go into creating a sense of like ethnic diversity and a cosmopolitanism. It's funny that it's an L.A. movie because that stuff's very New York. Not that it's not also L.A., right? Mm-hmm. But the demographics you see in Blade Runner almost sort of suggest, you know, that New York has been translated to the, to the West. And I mean, Year of the Dragon is such a, like, as you say, when you talk about it as an immigrant narrative, it's such a melting pot movie. And we should clear up that the main cop is not just a Vietnam War veteran, Stanley White, but like, he's pretty loud and proud, kind of like Polish.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
He
has a little bit of texture and density to him. He's not just a standard issue kind of white, waspy cop. And he is caught not just sort of, you know, in the world of Chinese organized crime, but like it's a war between the Italian mob and the Thai gangsters within the heroin supply chain and the Chinese triads, and the movie accommodates all of these different little groups and all of these different little subcultures. I don't know how much grace or respect it treats them with, but they're present.
Were you in Vietnam?
Yeah, why?
I knew it. It ruined you.
First time I saw you, I hated your guts. I think I even hated you before I ever met you. I hated you on TV. I hated you in Vietnam. You want to know what's destroying this country? It's not booze. It's not drugs. It's TV. It's media. It's people like you, vampires. I hate the way that you make your living sticking microphones in people's faces. I hate the way you lie every night at 6 o'clock. I hate the way you kill real feelings. I hate everything that you stand for. Most of all, I hate rich kids. And I hate this place. So why do I want to fuck you so bad? Maybe you're
right. I should mention at this point that I introduced a 70 millimeter print of Year of the Dragon at Bell Lightbox when they did a little mini retrospective on Cimino after he passed away. Trump had only recently become elected at this point. And my comments on stage as I introduced the film and tried to get people in the mood for watching this wretched excess on the biggest possible scale, which is the best way to appreciate a movie like this, is that the Stanley White character felt to me like a MAGA type. Like, instead of the fedora, he might as well have been wearing the Make America Great Again hat.
Right.
He's a patriot, but he's also, and he's a racist and he's a rabble rouser, but he's also really sentimental about how the world should have been. And he feels really sad about, you know, his fate in Vietnam. Like, his politics are motivated by his grievances. And that, you know, that's a quick way of describing the average Trump voter. And so Year of the Dragon feels even more like that to me now that we see that kind of politics playing out.
Well, and to bring up Rourke, who is one of the few celebrities who has actually been funny in criticizing Trump.
Yes.
Rourke, again, raise a glass to him. I mean, such a great persona.
Mm-hmm.
That his Trump critiques are great. I think there's one where he was threatening direct bodily harm, but he has some of that weird hysterical puffed up sentimentality that is part of the Trump thing. It makes Stanley White, like, he's not a Harry Callahan. You know, Harry Callahan, the whole point of the Dirty Harry movie is that he's completely numb. He is zen. You know, he gets mad when, you know, someone threatens to shoot school kids. But because Eastwood's acting is in a very, what's the word we're looking for, a very cool register.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he gets mad at his boss, but he doesn't shed tears. You know, Stanley White in Year of the Dragon, he's quite hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
He's hysterical. He's way more abrasive and kind of vulnerable with women than, you know, Harry Callahan ever has. Notwithstanding a Tightrope, which is pretty fascinating movie. And Rourke was not the first choice, right? Rourke had a tiny part in Heaven's Gate, but in the Elden book, at least, they talk about how they were trying to cast all kinds of people. They were thinking of Eastwood. They were thinking of Bridges, who'd worked with Cimino a couple times. They were thinking of Kris Kristofferson.
Mm-hmm.
Rourke really threw it for a loop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about the abjectness of Rourke's reputation in Year of the Dragon where they just go together so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, Rourke was too young to play this role. So, way too young.
He's grayed up for no reason.
Not only is he grayed up for no reason, but it's very inconsistent. And that was one of the things that I thought was so funny when I watched Year of the Dragon is from scene to scene, Rourke's gray hair changes shape, changes color. One of the reviews that I read at the time, Pauline Kael's review, she credited Elvis Mitchell as saying that Rourke had mood hair in this film. Like,
man, it took a lot for Kael to not like Rourke because she loved Mickey Rourke.
Yeah.
But in 1982, she was pretty convinced Diner was like the best movie that had ever been made in the United States. So, you know, there's no accounting for Pauline's taste.
Now, I wasn't a huge Rourke guy when I saw Year of the Dragon. I knew who he was, and I guess I'd seen Rumblefish. But when I saw Year of the Dragon, Rourke was like, ah, the 80s have been missing an actual Brando Montgomery Clift kind of movie star. And Mickey Rourke gives a movie star performance in this film, for better or for worse. You know, he's got a very difficult role to play in the sense that he plays a complete asshole. And he's also presented in the movie as the hero, even though he does some things that are unacceptable, says many things that are unacceptable. We're supposed to root for him. And that's the other thing that I found so confusing about Year of the Dragon when I first saw it, is that the good guy is a complete racist asshole. The bad guy is a very well-dressed and well-spoken, cool guy.
Yeah.
We're supposed to, I guess what Cimino's saying in the movie is that we're supposed to be on Rourke's side ultimately because he's right. He's on the side of righteousness. But his methods and tactics, you know, it also has to be said that he's a terrible cop on top of everything else.
Well, he is. And it's a movie that is, if not, you know, it's not an all cops are bastards, manifesto, but it's very dubious, not just about methods, but also about results. I mean, this was the thing with Dirty Harry, is that it had it both ways, where it kind of, you know, criticized lugubrious, lazy sort of bureaucracy, and basically said, you know, if only they could just like let Dirty Harry go, you know, he's the only guy who can deal with something as degenerate as the Scorpio killer, you know. Mm-hmm. But it also suggests in the end he's a great cop.
Yeah.
I mean, Mirror of the Dragon doesn't go so far as to suggest Stanley White's much of a cop. And that's where the chaotic Oliver Stone-ness comes in. I mean, he was just coming off Scarface, which is a movie about a racialized anti-hero and also very much an immigrant narrative. But Scarface, and there's a book coming out about it soon by Glenn Kenny that I really can't wait to read. You know, I'm excited to read an in-depth on the making of Scarface. Whatever you say about De Palma and the relative quality of Scarface, and it does not make my top 10 De Palma, it's not my top 15 De Palma, but I will say this, he's a satirist.
Yeah.
And even if his satirical muscle doesn't always exercise to the fullest, he fundamentally has never made a movie that's too self-serious that it's unintentionally funny. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as unintentional comedy in the world of Brian De Palma. Comedy is riven with intention.
Yeah.
Cimino is not a satirist, right? And so the collision of him and Stone is not the funny tension between a guy who takes everything too seriously and someone who's a skeptic. It's different. It's like a meeting of sensibilities that's like just so toxically pure, like paranoid, hyper-masculine, crypto-racist, so left they're right, so right they're left. They're too close, mm-hmm. you know? And that's why Year of a Dragon is tonally crazy, but it's also like of a piece,
mm-hmm.
you know? I think Stone and Cimino got along. What did Stone say about Cimino? Say it was the most Napoleonic director he ever met, which I think he meant as a compliment.
Yeah.
I can help you.
How?
I'll give you hard facts off the record. You do one of those exposés on Chinatown. 1 week you do the gambling connection. The next week you do the youth gang extortion racket. Move up the ladder. The bosses that own the places. You splash their faces on the tube. Take a little journalistic license, you know what I mean. Each week we peel another layer off the onion. I mean, if it was some white broad, they'd say it's racist. But with you, they gotta figure it's on the up and up.
This is outrageous. There are boundaries, Captain White, ethics. The press is independent. It's not just another undercover cop. What you're asking for is absurd. It's almost criminal.
You wouldn't know a real criminal if one popped out of the toilet and spit you on the ass.
I don't think there's any point in going on with this.
Sit down. You get smart. You listen to me.
Well, before we talk a little bit more about the plot and the activities of Year of the Dragon, I want to do a little lightning round with you, Adam. I'd be interested to hear what you think about some of the filmmakers that I've identified as being inspired by Year of the Dragon. First of all, I think Michael Mann is probably a huge Year of the Dragon fan. I detect a lot of similarities between what's going on in Heat and what's going on with Year of the Dragon, especially in terms of the cop with his marital troubles. Like, this movie's so overstuffed that it even has a subplot where Stanley's marriage to his long-suffering Polish-American wife, Connie, who's a nurse, he's neglecting her for his job. Although in Year of the Dragon, the cop has an affair with a young Chinese woman, a reporter. But the movie stops for 10 minutes to watch domestic squabbles that are, you know, a little over the top.
Well, Mann would have certainly watched it because his cinematographer, Alex Thompson, a great DP, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Who worked with no less than David Fincher on Alien 3 and who worked with Nick Rogue and Scott and John Gorman. He shot Excalibur, which is one of those beautiful movies in the 1980s.
And Alex Thompson shot The Keep.
And that's what I'm saying. Alex Thompson had shot The Keep. So Mann certainly would have paid attention. Yeah, you can see some of Heat. I mean, but that's also, you know, an interesting difference as a dramatist is whatever you say about you know, Mann having some of these little, you know, stylistic things that get the better of him. I mean, when he wants to, he can sit down and write a very compelling crime story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Year of the Dragon as a screenplay, as a story, as a narrative, as a, you know, one thing happening after another, after another, after another, it's kind of wobbly. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not like, you know, airtight pulp or anything.
No, this is melodrama and soapbox as well.
Yeah.
Like many characters in this movie start making speeches and reading encyclopedia entries to each other.
I think Mann is a, I think that's a credible shout. Mm-hmm. That he took something from this movie.
And Mann is obsessed with the dichotomy between the cop and the criminal who are trying to one-up each other, which is happening all the time in Year of the Dragon. Like Heat, this movie has a detailed widescreen photography that's very precise in framing. The editing is very precise and kinetic. There's a lot of lens flaring going on in Dragon. I think that Year of the Dragon probably directly influenced Stanley Kubrick on his recreations of Vietnam in Full Metal Jacket and of New York itself in Eyes Wide Shut, that I think that maybe Kubrick got the idea of how you can fool people with different by artifice. You know, I think that Wes Anderson is a Year of the Dragon head. There's a direct reference to Year of the Dragon in Rushmore. Yeah. During the Serpico play, we see a wiretapping nun, which is a direct lift from one of the funniest what the fuck moments in Year of the Dragon. I think that Year of the Dragon was probably pretty influential on Hong Kong action filmmakers.
Yeah. In a funny way, a sort of, you know, tradesies. Mm-hmm. You know, that conversation that American and Chinese action cinema have had over the years, back and forth, trading stars, Americans invading Asia, Asians invading America, mm-hmm. everyone agreeing to just meet on secret islands and just like fight it out in the Bruce Lee films.
When I watched the Hu Haoxian film Goodbye South Goodbye, I felt that maybe he was a Year of the Dragon fan. Especially the scenes in Year of the Dragon with the Chinese gangsters and the Chinese punks talking to each other, that felt a lot like that sort of realism of Taiwanese and Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation with Chinese cinema in the 80s is definitely a part of this movie. It's also a part of the package of the movie is that Eastern exoticism, mm-hmm. right? Which the movie codes in ways that are very sinister, but that have a certain rigor and mythos to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the thing about the Stanley White character and the great tradition of unhinged American, you know, protagonists like Ethan Edwards in The Searcher. This is not a remake of The Searcher spiritually the way that Taxi Driver is, but it's that idea of like an enmity and a racism that's so deep that it kind of comes out the other end and becomes this weird kind of respect mm-hmm. where there are lots of scenes of him hanging out with and talking to these triad members where I don't think the word that would be that he doesn't feel any superiority to them. There's contempt, mm-hmm. but it's contempt out of a sense of respect and contempt out of an understanding of sort of similarity. You know, it's like in The Searchers when Ethan talks about shooting out the
eyes.
Shooting out the eyes because, you know, then it's going to fuck them up in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. The Searchers is another movie where, you know, you can say that it's a masterpiece, but then you have to also have to rationalize defending the indefensible in terms of that film. The Searchers also, and the relationship between The Searcher and Taxi Driver, I think that the Stanley White character in this film is a lot like Travis Bickle.
Well, that's where I was going to go next. I was going to say he's in not just the Ethan Edwards tradition, but a bit of the Travis Bickle tradition. It's like, what if Travis Bickle had a badge?
Yeah. What if he was rewarded for killing all those pimps with a police position and he moved up the ranks But well, you know.
And the shootout scenes in this movie are fascinating for how nightmarish he is. I mean, he's terrifying when he's kind of, you know, on a spree. Mm-hmm. Stanley White. I mean, this is not like the Apollonian clarity of Harry Callahan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's nuts.
I don't think it's a direct influence, but I think it's also very noteworthy that a couple of months after Year of the Dragon came out was William Friedkin's To Live and Die in L.A. I think these two movies are related to each other as well.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they are too. And Friedkin is one of those new Hollywood monsters,
mm-hmm.
right, who got Final Cut early and had tremendous success and then had to sort of deal with a slight slackening of that grip on the brass ring. And
mm-hmm.
you know, then it's the 90s and he just wants out.
And Popeye Doyle is a racist, which the movie, I think Hackman had problems playing that part because of the racism of Popeye Doyle. But yeah, that didn't become the main subject of the movie the way that Year of the Dragon did.
Thankfully, we have giant multinational streamers to take offending words out of the French Connection. If you did that with Year of the Dragon, the film would be...
You have to take 20 minutes out.
2 minutes long. I mean, we should address, if not so much the plot, because it's a convoluted plot. I mean, we should not dance around the fact, as you've alluded to it a bit before, that the basic rhythm of the film is that in, you know, playing both sides against the middle or trying to parse the motives of these different triad families. I mean, not only is Stanley White sort of, you know, a white fish out of water, but he lets anybody know, especially, you know, his anyone in his office and by essentially anyone watching the movie. I mean, he's a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And the eternal discourse of, you know, does a racist character equal a racist movie? I mean, another movie, I'm surprised you didn't mention it as being a spiritual heir to this. I forget if it's one you've seen, but you've read about, is Dragged Across Concrete.
Of course.
Which begs the question, is this movie retweet or endorsement?
Yeah.
Is this showing something? Or is this advocating for something? And as people have pointed out about Year of the Dragon, Stanley White is our hero. He's the only hero we've got. I mean, kind of doesn't really do much good.
No.
You know, and you could, as a viewer, be left to sort of understand Year of the Dragon as a movie that's very self-aware of its own defeatism.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, that's one of the ways that Year of the Dragon sort of gets out of the wrestling hold to me, is that the movie is about failure.
Yes.
And the hero in this movie is a racist. He's a rapist, in fact. We could even say that. He's abusive. He is indifferent. He gets people killed all the time. Several people are jeopardized because of him. He is a blunt force instrument. He doesn't seem to learn very much. He's full of self-pity and remorse. But at the end of the movie, he basically fails, and he is a failure. And he even says at one point that he's an asshole. And there are characters in the movie that eventually get strong enough to call him an asshole towards the end of the film. He doesn't really have much to say to Tracy when she lets him have it, because she gets sexually assaulted by the Chinese gang, and this is after his wife has been killed, his informant has been killed, he's been kicked off the force, and then his girlfriend tells him that she was sexually assaulted, and he says he went too far this time.
Yeah, says went too far this time, and the movie doesn't really movie doesn't really mount much of a defense, right? I mean,
yeah.
It, as a cop movie, it has a little bit of that, you know, omelets and eggs attitude,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you, if you're going to make eggs of in this society, you got to smash some omelets. But I like how you mentioned the contrast between, you know, the two characters. I mean, it's then essentially the hero and the antagonist. I mean, I do always love, and it's a very Michael Mann thing when, you know, the good guy and the bad guy are mirrors of each other. I mean, John Lone as Joey Tai, you know, in some ways much more circumspect and respectable
mm-hmm.
and classy than mm-hmm. our hero.
Mm. And, you know, I mean, Cimino has that little smart visual touch. There are three funerals in this movie. That's how intense this movie is. And the film begins and ends with a Chinese funeral. And in Chinese culture, people wear white at the funeral. And the bad guy in this movie is introduced to us wearing white. And our hero, whose name is literally white, dresses in dark Giorgio Armani colors.
Correct.
And always wears a hat, and he's always setting his hat down all the time in the movie. Like the hat, you start following, your eye starts following the hat and where it's winding up in the frame. To double back a little bit about the immigration story of this movie, our hero named Stanley White is the embodiment of white supremacy and is enforcing assimilation on people. Like, he's after the Chinese because they don't play by our rules. At one point he says to Joey Tai, you know, you think that your traditions are kosher because they're 1,000 years old. Well, this country's 200 years old. So you guys better get your clocks fixed.
Which is a great line, and which is an Oliver Stone line, right? I mean, it's funny. Oliver Stone always, there's always, whether drugs are part of the story or not, like, he is the screenwriting equivalent of cocaine.
Yes.
You know, what if Kale said that he writes and directs like someone put a gun to his head?
Yeah.
Which, you know, it doesn't have to be a put down. But like Scarface, it is a movie that is not just reveling in violence, but it absolutely is dealing with a kind of, you know, capitalist, you know, people trying to gain a foothold or gain an entry into it, you know, into this very capitalist version of America. And how can I say it? It's not pro-triad, but in the same way that the film is tremendously, you know, features all kinds of epithets and put down and racism, it I don't know. It kind of gives the crime families their due. Like, they're sketched and drawn as individuals, and there's little pockets of like empathy or humor or respect for their characters. I don't know if you think I'm being too generous, but.
Well, and also we spend a lot of time with them. This is a big budget would-be blockbuster that has about 25 minutes of subtitled Cantonese dialogue. I know some people who think that the movie is sometimes boring. I'm on the edge of my seat for the whole movie because I even think the boring parts are exciting.
Well, I'm sure what you're responding to is the palpable sense of commitment by everybody involved. I mean, Cimino managed to get this whole group on board. I mean, it would almost be like someone saying, hey, you know, come with me on my next voyage. I know the Titanic sank.
Yeah.
But at this time.
Captain Stanley White, commander of the 5th Precinct and the most decorated cop in New York City, has declared war on Chinatown. Today, there were 43 gang arrests, 3 gambling parlors raided, 6 sweatshops busted, and now in an opening blow at the man who's been called the godfather of Chinatown, Joey Tai. Mr. Tai, can you tell us if there is such a thing as the Chinese Mafia?
Sounds very exciting, like a comic book.
The existence of triads is documented by the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Documentation without proof. This farce is further evidence of the consistent discrimination against Chinese in this country.
I do want to talk a little bit as well about, you know, the elephant in the room with this movie is, you know, the charges that this movie's racist. And, you know, I think it is and it isn't at the same time. When this movie opened, it was one of the few movies that had protesters in front of cinemas showing the movie. Like, I had to get through protesters to go and see The Last Temptation of Christ and Basic Instinct when they both opened.
Well, and some of that is residue from Deer Hunter, right? I mean, for anyone who... Most people have seen The Deer Hunter. I mean, The Deer Hunter is vile. Vile. It's not just the point of view of the characters. I mean, its portrayal of their captors is like a cartoon written by, you know, the Marquis de Sade or something. I mean, it's sadistic. It's cruel. It's vicious. I mean, he does not lack for a certain like punitive imagination when it comes to these Asian characters and this idea of violence. And you can't just wash it away with Year of the Dragon and be like, well, you know, it's an 80s genre movie, you know, who wasn't messing around with that stuff? Even by those standards, it's pretty gross.
Yeah, it's, well, but Year of the Dragon's pretty fucked up, but I think that the movie kind of recognizes the, certainly John Lone's Joey Tye character as a glamorous and in control personality. Like, it's like he's not a, it isn't so simple to call it a sort of racial caricature. The people that play the Chinese gang members in this movie are pretty full-blooded performances, even if the movies stack the deck against them.
They are full-blooded performances, and they're all in the context of, you know, as we say, Stanley White not exactly being, you know, a fine upstanding citizen. I mean, when I mentioned Dragged Across Concrete before, I mean, Dragged Across Concrete's a great contemporary case study of, you know, do racist situations and scenes and attitudes that belong to the characters, even if any character is just, you know, a mouthpiece for a filmmaker's ideology. You know, with Dragged Across Concrete, it's like, it's racially charged. Does that make it racist? I'm swifter to answer in the affirmative for Year of the Dragon.
Yeah.
There's no reclaiming this movie as stealth progressive or, you know, really ultimately having these deep human characters who are being held the whole time. I mean, it's quite cartoony.
But can you not enjoy a reactionary movie from a progressive point of view?
Sure. Sure. That's the Oliver Stone challenge.
Yeah.
Reactionary movie from the progressive point of view, or progressive movie from the reactionary point of view. You can enjoy it, and you can also enjoy it without lapsing into like Mystery Science Theater kind of like mockery,
mm-hmm.
too, because it does hold your attention.
Mm-hmm.
But it's appalling.
Yeah.
You know?
It's appalling, but it has a sort of, it has an undeniable charge.
Yo, it has an incredible charge, and it doesn't feel benign, and it doesn't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can only imagine what it would have been like to see it as you're describing it, to see it then,
to see it on that scale too, to be overwhelmed by it, to be watching that movie the way that one would go to the IMAX cinema to go watch Oppenheimer.
God damn you, Stanley! I was almost killed for you. I was raped, and I'm not going to die for you. I'm not going to be pushed like Connie and Herbert. They're dead because you pushed them until they were dead. You're like poison, Stanley.
Who did this to you? Who?
Rape is rape.
Who? Who raped you?
Three boys.
Who?
Three boys.
Who raped you?
Three Chinese boys, Stanley.
You went too far this time, that fucking Joey.
It didn't happen to you. It happened to me. You don't give a shit about me, do you?
What should we say about Ariane?
Well, it was her first movie, and she was a model, and she returned to modeling after this movie. It's weird because she got singled out for some of the harshest criticism that this film received.
Which will always happen, where you'll have a misogynist. It's bad enough that within the frame of the movie, she's treated that way. And then the critics will sort of be like, they'll double and triple down on that.
There's a scene where Stanley White seduces her, which is actually sexual assault.
Sure.
And the movie presents it as that she falls for him. And that makes the what happens to the character later in the movie, where she is sexually assaulted by a gang, and his sort of self-centered reaction to that makes it even grosser, because he also violated her trust. I want to read you something from the screenplay.
Yeah, please.
This is how the Tracy Zhu character is introduced. It says, 25 years old, Bryn Mawr bred. Her beauty has been thoroughly Americanized into that glamorous, aggressive edge of a career professional determined to make it. Everything about her is American. Manner, style, dialogue. Yet on this pure piece of Americana, like the head of a mutant sphinx, sits a truly stunning and refined Chinese face.
Lots of stuff to unpack there. I think that female characters are always, you know, they always suffer in these hyper male narratives. And, you know, we've already talked about the archetype of the nagging wife, which Stone would raise to an all-time art form in JFK.
Yes.
Where Sissy Spacek is like, oh, honey, can't you just come to dinner? The Kennedy assassination can wait. You know, I mean, Stone, never good on female characters, never good on domesticity.
You know what else was funny was when Born on the 4th of July came along a few years later, Ron Kovic's parents were played by Raymond J. Barry, who plays Rourke's best friend in this movie, and Carolyn Cava, who plays Stanley's wife in this movie. That's true. I think Carolyn Cava is very good in this film.
Yeah, that's actually that's an interesting casting, an interesting bit of casting continuity. I mean, look, she's there, the Ariane character in the movie. I mean, you know, it's another slice of exoticism. Mm-hmm. And the way that she's presented in her nudity is very, you know, it's like in Videodrome, the same year where they're talking about, you know, Samurai Dreams, the Japanese porno. I mean, you know, her sexuality is coded and presented sort of just as part of the whole Far East aesthetic that the movie has. I mean, there's no way to sort of apologize for any of that. It is what it is, but it's in an interesting conversation with the Deer Hunter.
Cimino was also a director who would cast unknowns to play significant female leads. Like Meryl Streep wasn't super famous when she was in The Deer Hunter. Isabelle Huppert, her first American film was Heaven's Gate. Ariane's not on that level, but I consider that the same kind of casting decision.
He fought for Huppert.
Yes.
In Heaven's Gate. In fact, there's a whole chapter, if not a whole chapter, there's long passages from Final Cut. Where they were just like, can it not be anybody else?
Yeah. And Stephen Bock realized that he was going to lose the war on this movie once he lost the battle to cast Isabelle Huppert, because he did not want her. But Cimino insisted on her.
And give Cimino, you know, that's a win for Cimino. He was only earmarking, you know, probably the major French actress of the late 20th, early 21st century. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, neck and neck between her and Juliette Binoche.
Now, Ariane has some sort of laughable line readings from time to time in this movie. I thought that the scene towards the end where she confronts Stanley after having been sexually assaulted is not bad.
No.
I think that it's she reads very powerfully in that scene. And I want to tell you one interesting thing, because, you know, there were a lot of millennials at the Year of the Dragon screening that I introduced. And I was talking to a woman after the film who said that she thought that there were some kind of accidentally based moments in that scene where she says to him, rape is rape, when he wants to know who raped her. And then when he says he went too far this time, she says, it didn't happen to you, it happened to me. And she was like, that's really, for a movie from the mid 80s to have that communicated was unexpected.
Yeah, although ultimately the subject of that scene is his rage and his vengeance and how it fits into the narrative.
But that's also one of the only scenes in the movie where he doesn't get the last word. Like, yeah. She tells him to shut up when he tries to say something else, and he walks out of the room finally. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting observation. It doesn't really forgive the mechanics of the plot. But you're a progressive audience looking for something progressive.
And what we should say is that for all the film's excess, and you are right that it is an excess of production design, it's an excess of racism, it's an excess of running time, it's not a movie that violates the decorum of genre. It does not subvert genre structure. I mean, in that sense, Stone, like, would become a much more avant-garde writer. Mm-hmm. Cimino, never really an avant-garde filmmaker. I mean, he's a narrative filmmaker. Year of the Dragon is a weird mix, because all the stuff we've said about how weird it is true, but it is left to right. And the script is somewhat mechanical, and the payoff and the resolution is just like a movie. You know? So any case for the film as being formally radical, I don't think is there. It's just quite impressively crafted, and that's not nothing. I mean, we're in a moment now where a halfway decent craftsman like a Denis Villeneuve sort of gets elevated to sort of godhead status. And they, again, you don't want to be reactionary and you don't want to be an old crank, but you're like, they used to make things in that country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like.
Well, you know, when I was talking to people after the 70 millimeter presentation, they were like, I can see why this movie impressed you so much to watch it on the scale. Like if you watched it on TV, so much of the power would be gone. But if you are confronted and subjected to it on this massive scale with massive production design, massive overacting, massive performances, massive visuals, Alex Thompson's wonderful. I think he was one of the great cinematographers, but one of the genius decisions of Year of the Dragon was to use a spherical lens that's almost fisheye for so much of the coverage. It makes the rooms kind of close in on you. It adds to the sort of claustrophobia and mania of the presentation.
Yeah, it makes the rooms close in on you never more than in the big shootout in the Chinese restaurant, where it's not so much who's chasing who and who's shooting. You're just like, how is there more restaurant?
Yeah.
You know? It's has the world shrunk to the size to have a Chinese restaurant? Is this Chinese restaurant the biggest freestanding structure? I mean, it's an incredible set piece.
Mm-hmm. You know, another filmmaker I forgot to mention when I was doing the lightning round is Quentin Tarantino. And Tarantino's on the record as saying that he's a big Year of the Dragon fan. One of the things that annoyed me about cinema speculation was that there was no Year of the Dragon chapter. That was basically what I've been waiting to read. A funny story about Kevin Thomas. He does a huge chapter on Kevin Thomas, who was the second string critic for the LA Times in Tarantino's description. He liked Year of the Dragon okay in his review, but when Tarantino hit the big time and with Reservoir Dogs, he was introduced to Kevin Thomas at an event, and he immediately grabbed him almost like Stanley White grabbing people and threw him up against the wall and started yelling at him about how he didn't like Year of the Dragon enough and was quoting whole stretches of the review that Kevin Thomas said, like, I wrote it, but he remembered it.
Did you do a cinema speculation pod?
I have not, no.
Strange book. I'm teaching some of it in the film critic class that I'm doing right now, because of course, you know, Tarantino's attempt to be Godard now extends to actually trying to write criticism, you know, the Godardian imperative in reverse.
Yeah.
And I would argue that as a filmmaker, Tarantino is also a bit of a film critic.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of these aspects of Year of the Dragon, you know, he's not exactly writing deep exegesis.
No, it's more like I want to hear him shoot the shit about movies as opposed to his deepest thoughts about films. I would have liked to hear him articulate what he loves about Year of the Dragon so much. There was a documentary a couple of years ago about Michael Cimino that was made in France, and they interviewed Tarantino for this movie, and he said that the 80s basically sucked, but there were about five movies that actually like broke away from the sort of self-censorship that American film was doing in the 80s, like never going over the line and stuff like that. And he said that there were five cop movies in the 80s that actually broke the mold and went past the line that he highly respected. And they were Manhunter, To Live and Die in LA, 8 Million Ways to Die, Scarface, and Year of the Dragon. And I think that's bang on. Those are the five for me too.
And if you threw all those things in the proverbial blender, You might arrive at the early 90s where he starts spitting stuff out.
Mm-hmm. But the Chinese restaurant in Year of the Dragon, the two-level Chinese restaurant with the band performing on stage and giant fish tanks at the entrance, it reminded me a lot of the House of Blue Leaves sequence in Kill Bill Part 1. And Tarantino also does a reference to Year of the Dragon in the animated sequence where Lucy Liu's character produces the severed head of her rival.
Yes.
He's definitely calling back to Dragon in those two parts.
It's very, 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 very Dragon for sure. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I watched the Blu-ray of this movie that was recently released by Imprint. I think it's out of print now. It was like a limited edition of 1500, and I bought it at our lovely new Vinegar Syndrome store in downtown Toronto. I'm so happy that it exists. The critic Peter Tongette is the guy who does the commentary track for this movie. And he describes this film as peak Cimino, where all of his madness is on the screen. But I really liked one of his descriptors to talk about this film. He said it was an example of visual congestion. Too much to look at all the time on the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, imagine someone accusing a movie of that now where we have congestion, but it's like phlegm.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I don't think, I would use a better adjective for Year of the Dragon. I would say it's teeming.
Yes.
Teeming. Everything about it exceeds while still fitting the template. You know? And Stone's storytelling would grow more genuinely radical and self-reflexive and Brechtian with time. But, I mean, in a way, what you could say about Year of the Dragon is you can see why De Laurentiis invested in it and why he thought it might be a hit, because its bones are conventional.
Yes.
But the conventional bones and the oddness and the mania and the obsessive revenge-fueled mm-hmm. attitude of the person making it, obviously.
One other creative that I want to single out their work on this film is the editor Françoise Bonneau, who's one of my very favorite editors, cut all the great Costa Gavras films. She cut Year of the Dragon and she cut The Sicilian for Cimino. Her work is spectacular, like the compression of time, the way that Cimino loves to shoot various locations that are all supposed to be in the same place. And it's Bonneau's editing skill that manages to combine three shots that were filmed in three different parts of the world into one sequence, where there's a sweatshop that Joey Tai's walking through that was filmed in Bangkok. Then they show them walking over a footbridge, which was shot in outdoors in New York City. And then they walk into a dingy apartment building that looks a lot like the apartment in Blue Velvet that was shot in Wilmington, North Carolina. But you wouldn't know it when you watch it.
No, I mean, you know, we're talking about technique. Even if it's not radical technique or avant-garde technique, it's so sharp. And that's the thing, is it's not like after Heaven's Gate, you know, Cimino lost his faith or his nerve or his ability to make movies. In some ways, stylistically, this one splits the difference between, you know, the intensity of something like Thunderbolt and Lightfoot and the pageantry of a Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. The scene where they go to Thailand could be out of Heaven's Gate. It has that majestic processional quality to it.
There's that scene where there's that confrontation in the nightclub where Stanley grabs Joey Tai and starts throwing him around in the men's washroom. And there's a gunfight where they cut to a soap dispenser being shot and all the soap flying everywhere. Then they run out of the club and into a boxing gym. That boxing gym was filmed in Vancouver. But when the girls run out of the boxing gym and they get into a gunfight in the middle of the street, their side of the action was filmed in New York and Rourke's side of the action was in Vancouver. At the screening in 70mm that I showed, everybody laughed and applauded when the punk girl is dying in the street after Rourke shoots her and she bounces off some taxi cabs. She reminded me a little bit of Joanna Cassidy in Blade Runner, actually. Blade She's Runner. Lying there dying. He says, anything you want to tell me before you go, sweetheart? And she says, yeah, fuck you. Everyone clapped because people were really liking when characters were finally telling him that he was an asshole.
Yeah, and there's a long line of them. They're lined up around the block to let him know.
Now, did you notice that they filmed a part in Toronto?
Which part is in Toronto?
There's I think that the scene where Tracy tells Stanley that she was assaulted was filmed in Toronto. That's a feeling I have from the mood hair. The part that's in that I flipped out when I realized it was Toronto is there's a scene where Rourke is driving his car and he's trying to pick her up as she's walking past a bank. That's the Bank of Montreal at King and Bay.
Oh, really?
They dressed it up to look like the Bank of New York.
I'll have to add it to my Toronto
place, on screen.
Toronto plays everywhere else montage. UT.
Hey, look, you're right. I thought it over. I tried very hard to suppress it, but I think there's definitely something between us. Why don't you get in the car? I'll drive you home.
You know, I'm not some gook hooker on the streets of Saigon. Does that work with all the girls?
Comme ci, comme ça. Hey, listen, why don't you give me a break? It's not every day I get to meet a famous person. Listen, I got a legitimate story for you.
Now, before we wrap it up, I want to talk about two more things quickly. the reaction from the Chinese community about this movie is worth talking about, because this film got so much heat when it came out that they had to add a disclaimer to it.
Yeah, they had to put a disclaimer, which was something to the effect of, you know, the movie you're about to watch is not meant to demean or vilify.
What was the one from Cruising? This film does not mean to attack the homosexual community, just one part of it, or something like that.
just one part of it. I mean, you know, it's funny you mentioned Cruising and Friedkin, because Friedkin, temperamentally, if you were making your Venn diagram or your y-axis diagram, he and Cimino very close.
Yes.
Right. And that idea that everything is permissible within the artistic space. And, you know, please don't mistake our personal bombast for the worldview of the movies. But I mean, I do think that the film warranted
a disclaimer. Yeah.
Although it warranted that kind of pushback, even though in some ways it was only by hyperbolizing that which was latent and present in every other cop thriller.
Mm-hmm.
We should say it's not like Year of the Dragon has the market cornered on racism in American cop movies.
No.
In some ways, it's so overt about it and deals with it so directly. It's like it wants to take abuse for all those sins.
Now, in terms of the lawsuit against this film, because they put the disclaimer on saying that, you know, any similarity between the depiction in this film and any organization, association, individual, or Chinatown that exists in real life is accidental, which is a very funny way of phrasing it.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. We should point out that the film ended up making like, what, about three quarters of its budget back?
Yeah, so it was not a giant hit. Might not have been worth suing over. But here's what happened. There's an establishing shot of a building. I think it was shot in Vancouver, where it's Joey Tai is having a meeting with his guys in there, is what you're supposed to think. But the establishing shot has a Chinese sign. The characters translate as Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association. And the real benevolent association sued MGM United Artists for the inference that they were involved in crime. They're associations that help immigrants settle in the United States and also to act as sort of go-betweens so that they don't go to the cops, which is something that this movie's about. Yeah. I don't think the lawsuit was successful, but interestingly, the film print that I introduced, which was from a private collector and I think was from Britain originally, that shot was removed from the print.
Is that the only thing that was cut from this movie?
I believe so, yeah. To wrap up our discussion on Dragon, I detected Year of the Dragon as being a thinly veiled apologia slash mea culpa and defiantly so from Cimino. Like, it's the closest that we ever came to him explaining himself as an artist in any of his films.
Absolutely. And is it the only way that he can do it is to create, again, racist, prejudiced, loose cannon cop battling criminals on what he worries about is his home turf. And you have to push through all that.
Stanley White is always describing himself as the most highly decorated cop in New York, which is like the best director, best picture winning.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, he somebody says, "You care too much, Stanley." And he says, "How could anybody care too much?
How can we care too much?" And that's the thing, though. That's the temptation with the auteur is to read the work as autoportrait. I mean, I fell into this a bit this year with David Fincher and The Killer, which is a movie that is almost daring you to read it as generic and uninhabited by any kind of artistry until you look at it as a portrait of the artist, and then it actually activates and becomes quite. Quite spacious and interesting interpretively. So yeah, I have some time for the idea of Stanley White as a vicar for Cimino.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of Christ imagery in this movie anyway, right? Even Stanley gets shot in the hand. When his fellow cops are yelling at him, they sound like the suits at United Artists yelling at him about Heaven's Gate. Like his friend says, "You know what your problem is, Stanley? You move through this department like a piece of heavy machinery. No one likes you. They all tell you you're a great cop, but they don't like you."
Yeah, I mean, how much more direct can you be without getting up onto the couch? Right.
Yeah. And at the very end of the film, a line that was superimposed on the movie by the studio, when Stanley is walking into the sunset with Tracy, He says to her, "You were right. I was wrong. I'm sorry. I'd like to be a nice guy. I would. I just don't know how to be nice." And that totally sounds like Cimino's epitaph.
Yeah, but what's the line that replaced?
The line that it replaced was something which sounded very Oliver Stone-like, where he says, "Well, you fight a war long enough, you eventually marry the enemy."
Yeah, which is like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. As a hitting the nail on the head. But yeah, I mean, I buy the idea of it as a self-portrait to an extent.
Yeah. Self-aggrandizing self-portrait.
Self-aggrandizing self-portrait. And again, that idea of, you know, Rourke is so, he's so rumpled and dashing and handsome, even at rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
One of those performances where you can kind of get away with the director thinking, this is really me. You know, I'm this rumpled, romantic bad boy.
Yeah. It's a defiant work by a guy who was not destroyed by Heaven's Gate, but it is also a movie made by a director who never really had that kind of access to a brass ring ever again. He became a recluse.
The movie, it's analogous to, it's sort of like Hollow Man.
Yes.
Although Paul has now come back as a great, you know, French art filmmaker, but it's the movie where you're not in movie jail for life, or they've like let you out on parole.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really got to like nail it.
Yeah.
You know? And it wasn't enough to keep him out of his own private movie jail.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think anyone at the time thought it was horrible. That's the thing.
Well, Roger Ebert and Leonard Maltin both reviewed it where they were complaining about what's the matter with it. But then they said, "But I got to say, it is incredibly well made. Like you will not be sorry to watch this movie."
Yeah, it was the you gotta hand it to him defense.
Yeah,
the drill ISIS tweet.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know. I'm not going to bring up Showgirls, you know, 2 hours into your podcast, but every time I've shown Showgirls at a theater, at least one person comes up after and says, "Why did anyone ever think that's bad?"
Mm-hmm.
And that, because the craft is just so good. I mean, I'd say the same thing with Year of the Dragon. An audience watching it now who maybe wasn't around for it, they're watching it now, they're going to think it's beautifully made. And it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Craft's not the issue.
We should be so lucky to have failures that are this good.
We should be so lucky to have successes that are this good. You know, let's be honest for sure.
But it really does need to be seen on a massive scale. Like you should see it for sure.
Yeah, and with people reacting to it spontaneously in real time, which is part of what's funny about it being such an erratic synaptic movie is people sometimes don't know how to react to it. You've made me want to watch it even again on top of prepping for this, so I appreciate that. Any other residual business that we should hit on the way out quickly?
We should say a proper farewell to CinemaScope. I've been following the last couple of months. I guess the difficult decision's been made to sort of wrap it up, and I hope it takes another shape or form. But you know, this was one of the first publications that published my film writing, and I've met all sorts of wonderful, thoughtful people who are associated with this magazine, and you certainly included, and you've been one of the driving forces to keep this magazine going.
A lot of people worked very hard, and I don't think that the magazine ending undermines or disrespects anyone's efforts. It just speaks to how hard it is to keep an independent print publication going. And Mark Parenson, the editor of Scope, did 97 issues.
Mm-hmm.
25 years without institutional support. I mean, government grants and self-financing and the sort of skeleton crew. And, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners are probably Scope readers or subscribers. And I'm just sad that it came to this. Not sure who, if anyone's going to be able to step into the breach. You know, I was really hoping The Weeknd was going to come through and buy it because he is a subscriber. But I guess Abel's got... you know.
We don't have Dino De Laurentiis anymore to underwrite this thing.
We don't have Dino De Laurentiis, and we don't have Michael Cimino either, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, RIP Scope, and I hope that whoever tries to create a publication is some totally new person, younger. It shouldn't be one of the leftover people. It should be like Mark was. It should be something new,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to trying to keep this thing on life support unnaturally.
Mm-hmm. Adam, what have you been up to, and where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, Brother From Another on Twitter. You can read me in The Ringer. You can read me sometimes, as Jesse said off the top, in New Yorker for film stuff. Lately, I've just been working on a new book, which hasn't been announced. I feel like if I say what it's about here, you know, if one of your famous listeners retweets it, the cat will be like, let's just say it's a book about a company whose curation and canonization of films is probably going to be very familiar to your listenership, and a company that I think a lot of people would love to see put out, you know, Year of the Dragon. I'll leave it at that. And yeah, thanks for having me on. I had a great time.
Yes, thank you so much. Come on back anytime. We'll do a Sicilian episode next time.
Oh my God.
You know, we should do a Brian De Palma episode, you and I.
We should do a Brian De Palma
episode. Let's think about it.
Rather than planning it to mark his hopefully long, long, long delayed, hopefully long from now, I'm saying, you know,
yeah. Well, and I've only talked about Femme Fatale and Domino, so everything else is still available to you.
Yeah, well, let's just hope that there's a good, you know, that we could do it to celebrate his 90th birthday or his 100th birthday. You know, he's got to live forever. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I had a great time.
Patrons of this podcast help to make Junk Filter possible. To become a patron and to receive access to bonus episodes every month, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter @junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken, and thank you for listening.